It's easy to take the public library for granted, but it took a movement to bring palaces to the people. From SDPB, today is Monday, March 3rd. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Free for All. We preview a documentary history of the public library in America with the filmmakers who tell the story anew. We check in on the history of librarian spies in World War II. That's coming a bit later in the hour. But first, innovative library services and programs in South Dakota. We'll check in with the State Library about talking books and braille services. And we've got tips on how you can volunteer to record South Dakota materials for local readers. Plus, we check in with a library in Milbank where the neighbors show up to learn how to be more neighborly by learning the language of one another. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. This hour, we are exploring the power of the public library, including services and programs in South Dakota. Later in the hour, we'll talk with the filmmakers of a new documentary. It's called Free for All, and it's about the history of the public library and the librarians who envisioned what palaces for the people might have to offer. But first, innovative library programming right here in South Dakota. We begin in Milbank. Tammy Wolschlager is director of the Grant County Public Library. The library is bringing together neighbors who want to be more neighborly. That includes English language learners and kids who gather on the carpet for bilingual story time. There are many things we could talk about with your programming, but you've had some success, especially with English language classes recently. Tell me a little bit about these.
Right now, we have a session going, and it is the seventh session that we've had since we filled, did it with the grant. And honestly, it's really been kind of a work in progress. I don't know that we've done any two sessions the same. Okay. We're having to adapt on the fly, and even who's teaching it. You know, the first teacher did it that first year. She did the first two sessions. And she ended up moving out of town. So we were back to square one again. We were lucky enough to find a couple ladies to come in. One had taught ELL at a college. She had that experience. The other one had no experience at all, but she was a retired English teacher from our local school. And so she came in and said, well, we'll try it, And so they did an absolutely fantastic job with it as well. And we now currently have another a man teaching, and he's unique. When I first did the research, I was told, don't worry about if they can speak Spanish. That's not needed, as sometimes it's better if they don't. We found out that there are some challenges with that. And now we've kind of gone where we have one guy who's teaching it. He has done quite a bit of teaching in the school. So he has experience and he's fluent in Spanish, but is a local guy. So he has the ability to speak English and Spanish, and we found that's really been a nice. And right now, so many people asked if we would teach Spanish, and so we've expanded to have Spanish class and English class. So he does them somewhat back to back, So we have both of those, and right now I think we're looking at about we're just a small community, so for us to have 15 people is what we're averaging in a class. It's still going really well for us.
Who are your students? Who comes in the door?
Well, most of the people who we've had are, to take this, the English as a second language class is, of course, mostly Spanish speakers. But we did have one who was from China. So we thought that was kind of unique. And so, again, that required a little bit of adjusting to that. But, they've done really well with adjusting on the fly with that stuff. And as far as who's taking the, this is our second session right now where we're offering the Spanish. Sure. It's a second session of teaching Spanish. And I think that has been really interesting. There's been some young, some older in there. And the one thing that we keep hearing is people just really here want to be neighborly. They want to be able to communicate with people who are right in the community. We want to be able to say hi and greet them in the grocery store. So, everybody seems to have a different reason why they're doing it. Some people, it's maybe a little will help in their career, help in their jobs, but most people, it's really just about community.
They want to know their neighbors and be able to talk to them.
Exactly. Yeah.
And they meet at the library to do that.
They do. They do. Back when we were in the grant year, where we did the two sessions, one of the things that we did is we kind of expanded into living in Grant County, what that looks like, because when we talked to them, there was things that we were surprised that they needed. We just talked to them, what do you need? And some of the things that they came up was they were confused about some things that happen, the way people drive, or what to do if they're pulled over by a police officer. So one of the weeks we had a police officer come in and speak to them about that. They talked about how awkward sometimes it is to go into a local restaurant because they're asked how to cook their steak or asked how to cook an egg. And they said, well, we're just used to having it cooked. We don't want to have to answer how. So, there's just some cultural differences and things they needed to learn. So we had a restaurant owner come in and speak to them about how to tip and how, what's expected and different things like that. So that really worked out nice, I think, to have that. The biggest one probably was we had a doctor that came in. I think she was a nurse practitioner, and she spoke to them about healthcare. And they were very, very, they had fantastic questions, and she was great to answer them. Just how prescriptions are handled. How to go about making a doctor appointment, what you're going to be asked, what you need to give, what information. They use their last names are a little different. So they talked about the importance of making sure they're giving those both and what gets in the system. And so it was that was a good thing.
And feedback from the community, it seems like something that are you noticing? People saying hello to each other. Are you noticing an increased friendliness or increased use of the library itself?
Oh, I think so. I think that, I always say one good program feeds another, and they do well. If you come to our summer reading program, you will see a lot of the Hispanic families are taking part in that. I just think they're more comfortable. I think they feel like we're in their corner. And so that's been a positive thing. But I think for the most part, that's just a good thing going here in Grant County where the families are working together that way.
Are you picking up any Spanish yourself?
I wanted to take the class this year and I couldn't get it done. One of our other employees did, and she really enjoyed it. She says it's been a good thing. But I didn't do it. I
You
did lead a conversation class not very long ago, about a month ago. I kind of subbed in there one week when our teacher was missing. And I thought it was fantastic. And just to sit and talk, how much you learn from each other is really a neat thing. It's really beautiful. I have said before, everybody should just get to sit in on one sometime just to see how neat it is.
Up next, the South Dakota State Library serves many functions, including as a library for libraries across the state. I talked with Josh Easter. Now, I first met him at the South Dakota Festival of Books, where he was sharing information about the state's talking book and braille programs. I connected with him from the State Library in Pierre.
I work in the State Library in the Accessible Library Services, or the Braille and Talking Book Library. I have many roles, but one of them is working with volunteers to provide materials, South Dakota materials, in accessible formats. That's one of my roles. And then I work with a lot of the staff just to keep our daily services going and go out and talk and do, outreach in the field as well.
And that's where we met. We met at the South Dakota Festival of Books, and I came up to your table and you had these wonderful devices to show people. Tell me a little bit about the equipment that people have access to, and of course, who has access to it, who can be in the program to get access to some of this equipment.
We have the talking book players. They're basically audiobooks, but we call them talking books because they are a specialized format, because we can record any book or magazine to make it accessible as long as we're only providing it to qualifying people. So for copyright law. And we're part of a network of libraries across the country that work with the National Library Service for the Blind and Print Disabled out of DC. And they're part of the Library of Congress. And so they provide free equipment to people who qualify. So we have the talking book players, and that allows people to listen to the audiobooks. We also have a refreshable Braille, e-Braille e-reader is what they're called. And those are also available for people that read Braille. So that's more of a specialized thing. Mm-hmm. Then we also have the Bard mobile app as well on smart devices. So your iPads, your Android devices, Kindles, those can all access that. They also are piloting, the National Library Service is piloting Amazon Alexa, so people can listen to talking books on there, and you can also read them on PC. It's just expanding. There's more and more options.
How do you qualify? Well, proceed. So as you say, you're starting to lose your vision, or you know somebody who this would benefit. How do they start getting qualified for the program?
Absolutely. So originally it started out just serving blind adults and then children. And then they added physical impairments that make it hard to hold a book or, turn pages. So, and then more recently, we've added reading disabilities such as reading processing disabilities, such as dyslexia and other things like that. So, a lot of people think, oh, I have to be blind. No, if you are starting to lose your sight, if you have a diagnosis, if you have an extreme dry eye condition where you can only read for a short period of time, that will qualify you. We have people who are allergic to ink or paper, mm-hmm. so they can't deal with standard print materials, and so they would be our patrons. We have students that have dyslexia or low vision. And they qualify. So basically, if you have a hard time reading standard print, I should define what standard print is. Anything below 14 point, large print is considered 14 point and above. So that is standard print is below that. So if somebody has a hard time reading that, those kind of materials. So if somebody needs large print, then they would also qualify. And so we work in tandem with a lot of public libraries because, you know, we say we don't replace them. We are kind of a partner of the public libraries in the state to provide additional services.
Yeah. All right. So the volunteers, are they reading South Dakota material then? Because there would be national material that would already be given to you from a publisher, for example. But so what kind of materials are your volunteers reading so that people can listen?
Yeah. So our volunteers are reading South Dakota and regional interest materials, a lot of South Dakota authors. So we have, you know, fiction books, mysteries, pioneer stories. People love those. And also we will record like South Dakota history, mm-hmm. a lot of South Dakota Historical Society press books. We do as well a lot of magazines. So we do South Dakota Magazine, Dakota Country, Dakota Farmer, several others as well. And so just to allow patrons in our state to be able to access these materials. So a lot of people will still subscribe to South Dakota Magazine for the pictures, but the print is so small that they can't read it. So that works really well.
I love that. All right. Who can volunteer and how do you volunteer?
You can talk to me. You can go to our website at library.sd.gov/ALS. And there is a part where it says to volunteer and you can fill out a form. And we have recording studios in several locations in the state. We have Pierre, of course, in the state library. And then we have Sioux Falls and Vermilion and Rapid. And then we have Aberdeen as well. And we're working on some other sites as well.
Yeah, I love this. All right. So talk about some of the other programs that you have going on. Winter reading, summer reading. What else is new in your world?
Yeah, so we're currently in winter reading in February and March. So we have a cartridge with 6 books that the adults will read, and we call it an adult reading challenge. All of the books this time all of them are South Dakota books except for one. So, and there's various genres. So we always call it a challenge because then it gives people something outside of what they may normally read. Yeah. Then the kids also, we encourage them to read every day, and they have like a calendar where they mark things off. And then we also have our summer reading programs, in the summer months as well. And then we also have our social club. Quarterly is what we basically do it. And so that could be a We're going to discuss all the books for winter reading in our upcoming one. We also have author talks where authors will come. We had Eliza Blue come and talk about her latest book, and we're still recording her latest book, but we did record her previous book as well. So that was really fun for her to hop on Zoom and talk to people across the state that use our program.
Nice. Do volunteers record a full book? Like if you volunteer, then you're going to read perhaps, for example, all of Eliza Blue's book.
Exactly. Okay. Yes. So the volunteers typically read the whole book. Occasionally we'll do a special project where, you know, there's several different viewpoints. And so we'll have one volunteer read this. That works usually better for magazines. But yeah, you're usually committed. But there are different projects. So like if you only have so much time, I'll maybe give you some kids books or some shorter books.
I'm very good at reading kids books. I'm filling out the volunteer application this afternoon.
Perfect.
I am so excited that you're doing this work and that this exists for the people of South Dakota to get this material. It's shipped right to their home. Do they go to their local library and pick up materials? How do you get the materials to people?
So we do ship directly to their house. It's all free matter for the blind. So the federal government pays itself, basically. They pay the Postal Service so much to deliver for us. We send a mail card with their address. They just flip that card over, send it back to us. And so those are cartridges that fit in our talking book players. Of course, I did mention the Bard mobile app as well, and that you know, download books directly to it. And so you can do that anytime from home. People can also download books from the website as well, two cartridges they have at home, and stick it so they don't have to wait for the mail. Which is really nice as well. There's lots of options to read.
Yeah. Connect with Josh Easter at the South Dakota State Library. I want to describe on the radio the equipment that you showed me before we hit record, which is the Braille machine that changes
as you go. Refreshable Braille e-reader.
The refreshable Braille e-reader. Describe that to listeners so they can understand exactly what this does.
So this player has a row of dots. So Braille is six dots typically. This actually has extra pair of dots for there's different kinds of Braille. And so the dots will pop up and then you hit a button to refresh and then a new row of dots will pop up. So like the next sentence of the book will pop up. Yeah. So this is a small book, maybe a hardcover book size. And people can carry this with them instead of a large, because Braille takes up a lot of space. So a typical book will be pretty large to carry around, but you can carry around hundreds of books because they're all electronic. And this machine also has buttons on it, the Perkins keyboard, so people can type into it like what books they want, and they can download books directly to it as well.
This is a miracle device.
It truly is. It's transformative.
Transformative.
So we also work with schools and teachers to provide accessible textbooks and other educational materials that they may need for, you know, learning math or science, English. And we do some large print, but a lot of Braille and tactile graphics. So tactile graphics, they'll be raised images where, it, you know, like there, here's the mitochondria of the cell. So you have to, you can feel it because you can't see it. So you don't really understand unless you have some way to access that. So we work with the School for the Blind, but also schools across the state. And one thing I want to say is, get those orders in as soon as possible for textbooks. Yeah. We just want people to know that we are here to help provide these materials. So actually in the state prison in Sioux Falls, they have a Braille unit in Pheasant Land Industries that creates these textbooks. It takes 6 to 9 months really to do a whole textbook. So we just want people to know about us so that they can get out there and order those through us as soon as possible.
That's Josh Easter with the South Dakota State Library. We'll put links up on our website at sdpb.org. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. It's easy to take the public library for granted. It's free, it's consistent, it's staffed with a universe of information and people who will help you navigate it. A new PBS Independent Lens documentary explores the history and quiet revolutionaries that made the library system possible. You can learn all about it on the film Free for All, Inside the Public Library. I spoke with two of the filmmakers, Don Logsdon and Lucy Faulkner, via Zoom.
It was actually Lucy's idea. In the beginning, we were finishing up another film that was very deep in history too and required a lot of historical research. So we were spending a lot of time in archives and libraries. And we were at the New Orleans Public Library, and she looked around, and all kinds of things were going on, as usually is in big urban libraries. And she's like, "This is a movie." And I said, "Oh, I'm sure somebody's done that movie already." And she did a little research. And yes, there have been lots of films on individual libraries, but nothing on what the public library means to the nation as a whole across time. And eventually we decided it was a road trip because libraries are so local, unlike a lot of our other national institutions where they're the same in different places. Each library is really shaped and funded and defined by their community, whether that's the town or the county. They do get some federal and state money, but for the most part, they're up to their individual communities, and each one is so different. So we hit the road, which was really fun.
Lucy, what was in that moment for you where you looked around and just thought, okay, this can sustain a full-length project, the years that it will take to make it, it's this.
The other film that we were making was about a neighborhood in New Orleans and had to do with a lot of, music. And so we were interviewing musicians, and they were very, very kind in letting us film them. And then if you'd ask them a question, they'd say, "Yeah, baby, I'll call you, I'll text you about that information." And nobody would ever call, and you'd have to follow up about five times. But at the library, whenever we were doing research there, and I asked a question or I was looking for something, they would either find it immediately or they'd say, "Oh, I don't know, I'll get back to you." And by the time I got back to my desk, it was in my inbox, whatever it was, and then 10 other things that I could possibly want. So that was one of the things, like, I love librarians. We were finishing this other film, and Hurricane Katrina, sort of blew that up, and we had to redo that one. So it took a while before this one started taking form again. And what happened during Katrina is we evacuated to Baton Rouge. And in Baton Rouge, we only thought we were going to be there for about, a weekend, because we just had, some shorts and t-shirts and flip-flops. And then we realized, like, we could not go home. And so when that realization happened, and all communication was cut off because of, the cell phone towers were down and such, we went to the local public library so I could get on. I'm from San Francisco, get on the computer and let people know that, we were alive and well and safe. And that's when we discovered the librarians were first responders. And they were all there at the East Baton Rouge Public Library, with having people sign up for library cards so that they could get on the computer, and they had forms for FEMA, they had Red Cross forms, they had area, a whole list of places to you could find, loved ones in the Superdome or in the Astrodome, or where to find your pets. I mean, it was just amazing. And help with people filling out insurance forms. That's kind of what really solidified it for me.
And Don, you have a hurricane story as well, right? When you were a child, the hurricane's coming, and your mom takes you to the library to stock up on books beforehand. That blows me away, yeah?
And then we went back and filmed. Towards the end of the film, you see some librarians who are in Baton Rouge helping with a flood in 18, when Baton Rouge had an unprecedented flood. We went and filmed wildfire up in Northern California, when libraries were there handing out masks to protect people from the smoke and opening up the libraries so everyone could get online. Libraries are there during civil unrest when they're open, when everything else is closed. Got some footage from, was it Ferguson and Baltimore and some other cities where the library was sort of like the safe space for people to go to. So that was all really fascinating.
And then we dive back into this history. Lucy, you said, I love librarians, and boy, you've found some librarians from history here that are names I had never heard of, and now I can't believe I haven't read a whole biography of them. Let's talk about some of these early people, and in South Dakota, particularly, some, let's start with Ludi Stearns, who is really interested in rural living and people in rural areas in Wisconsin, and just how difficult their lives are. They need mobile libraries. Who wants to tell me about her?
I'm the one who fell in love with the history to the greater extent. And my mom's family is from Wisconsin. So we have deep Midwest roots, Midwest, Southern, and then she's West Coast. And most library stories really focus on and start in New England with Ben Franklin and, Thomas Jefferson. And we just decided to take a different approach and look at some of these people that nobody had ever heard of, including us. And Ludi Stearns was from a fairly middle-class family until the Civil War, when her dad went off to war and left her mom with 13 kids, and didn't come back. And so her mom ended up being a single mother, having to raise these kids without being able to leave the house and get a job. So she did like night work, stitching and making things. And that really profoundly shaped Ludi's life. And she became dedicated to education and the less fortunate. She was hired by one of the first public programs. It was run by the state. It was called the Wisconsin Free Library Commission. And it was run by a man, but she was the one who was hired to like institute the program and go around and get communities signed up and deliver the books. And if you know anything about, well, you do, of course, the Midwest in the late 1800s, it was still frontier land. And so she went out in buggies and barges and freezing cold weather through the mud, and she left behind these very colorful, very fun sort of sense of humor diaries that we were only able to excerpt in very small amounts. She really transformed the idea of rural library service and also service to children. Because at that time, children were either completely banned from libraries or made to feel very, very unwelcome. It wasn't like, oh, there's a cute little children's room here where you can go and, have story time. And she just decided, like, we need to meet children where we are, have books that they want to read, and not have it be this sort of barrier to them reading. And what I learned is that she went to the little village where my grandfather grew up and my great grandmother. And it just was interesting to me that, like, oh, it actually touched my own family, this woman. So,
And your great grandmother had one book, right?
The Bible.
Her Norwegian
She was a
Bible.
very devout Lutheran.
And
And, maybe she had a seed catalog at some point or something along those lines, but the only book we ever heard about growing up was her Bible.
this gets this idea that reading might do something to you. It might make you idle. It might make you not be out working and fighting those thoughts inside the head. So already early, we have this sense that although librarians are seeing the need for services, other people are already saying, wait, this might be the work of the devil that just came to town. Not to put too fine a point on it, but keep those hands moving and not just turning pages. And that's a
Absolutely.
fascinating thread for anybody who thought that was maybe a new invention. This is always part of the tension of a public library in some way.
Been there since the get-go. You can go back thousands of years to the burning of the Library of Alexandria, all the way through, for me, my knowledge of book banning really starts with World War II and the McCarthy era. But as soon as the first big city public library opened in Boston, people were outraged about what was available there. And it was, then it mainly, well, then like now, it often had to do with sexual topics. So Madame Bovary, who was an unfaithful wife, who had an affair, all those kinds of things were considered, highly immoral and especially dangerous for women to read. So there were lots of separate rules about who could read what.
Lucy, tell me, this is not a given that that everyone would have access to a free space and be able to check out books for free or get information for free. Where are these ideas coming from that this is a uniquely American kind of manifestation of libraries?
There's a bunch of libraries that are claiming to be the first public library, and it all depends on, what you define as public library. Like, is it open to everybody and you can just take whatever you want, or is it funded by the community? Is it funded by, grants or whatever? So there's all kinds of things. I guess, I mean, the start of it was kind of with Ben Franklin. You know, books were rare and expensive, and so they didn't have, he didn't, and not everybody had like a lot of books at their home. And so he and all of his buddies got together and pooled their books and started the Library
Philadelphia.
Company of Philadelphia. Thank you. And but you had to be a member to get in there, and you had to pay a bit of money to get in there. And then it eventually, he was all about the public good, Ben Franklin, but eventually regular people wanted access to it. They had a big library movement, and it's mostly by women.
I just want to be clear that the United States didn't start public libraries or free public libraries. There's some going all the way back to, I think it's Mesopotamia. There's a few records. England was really on the forefront of it before we were. But what happened in the United States is that it became a reality. So it wasn't just one community, and it wasn't just the big city where you had to go downtown. Thanks to, in large part, Andrew Carnegie and all these women's clubs all across the United States, it actually happened in almost every significant community. And that was the first time that that ever happened. This idea of it spreading and taking off and becoming a national idea. It's also the first time we were the first country to have it become a women's profession, where it was like actually led by women, which I found really fascinating.
Is this because Mr. Dewey is wants to be surrounded by women and will eventually be sort of kicked out of the club for his behavior with women? But is, I mean, how much of the fact that women come into this field in America really has to do with the fact that he wanted a bunch of young single women around him?
Oh,
And it
I
was
think that
also.
that's oversimplifying it a lot, but he did,
But
you know.
it was also because women were you could pay them less than a man, and there's a quote that came out of the film at one point where women were more attuned to tedious tasks, basically, things like the card catalogs that they had to sort through. So yeah, no, it wasn't just because he liked women, but yeah, he could pay them less and then take advantage of it in other
He
ways.
was actually really a pioneer in opening the field up to women, and he was also a bit of a pervert, apparently, in terms of inappropriate behavior with women. But the two things are true. He really broke a lot of very, very important ground for women being able to have opportunities within the profession, and he went out on a limb to do it too. So when he wanted to open his first the first library school in, I believe it's the world, like first professional library training school, it was originally at Columbia University, and they were like, absolutely no way are we letting women join. And he insisted, and they moved him off campus. He had to open his first classes in like closets in some building off the grounds, and eventually Columbia kicked the school off altogether and had to move to upstate New York. But he was really committed to this idea of opening it up, in part for benevolent reasons, or justice reasons, in part because of what Lucy said, which is like he could convince people that librarians would be cheaper if they were women. And then, who knows what else was going on in his mind. It wasn't just women that he attacked. He was a virulent anti-Semite racist. He was definitely a man of his time with lots of flaws. But he is kind of the great granddaddy of shaping the movement,
The
because
education,
he started the library school, he started the American Library Association, he started Library Journal. I mean, I don't think
Dewey
there would
Decimal
have
System?
been. Oh yeah, the Dewey Decimal System, of course. That's what he's famous for,
Love that.
and tons of other things.
And some of these other women who go out and change how library services are going to apply to people in the South, to Black people, to children, as you mentioned. Let's talk about another library vanguard. Who else comes to mind that you want to say this is a woman who really came along and changed how we consider library services?
Ernestine Rose in New York, the New York Public Library. She was down in the Lower East Side, which has always been sort of a new immigrant neighborhood, And she, there was a lot of people living in the tenement buildings down there, and she helped get languages, books in languages of the people who lived there. So, you know, there's a lot of Yiddish, there was Italian, there was Russian, there was all kinds of people down there in the tenements, and people would flock to it because it was a place that was roomy. You know, they weren't living, there wasn't like five people to, you know, to a chair in their house, and it was warm in the winter time and cool in the summer. And then she later was called up to, she actually went to world, she was in World War, there's a whole section that we didn't get into the film, but she was actually called up in World War I to help educate the black soldiers and teach them reading. And then when she came home, she was sent up to Harlem, and she was she hired the first African-American and Puerto Rican librarians up in the branch there that eventually became the Schomburg Center. She helped brokerage this collection of African and African-American books and artifacts, and it became the sort of the hub of the Harlem Renaissance in that library. Yeah. All kinds of famous people came through there.
It's fascinating. Dawn, you also talk in the film about the decades-long clawing back of funding and what it is costing us as we reevaluate what it means to have a public library, what it means to have a public space. What are you seeing happening in libraries across the country now, especially as you do these interviews to talk about the film? You're hearing from people from all these different states who are telling you stories about what's happening in their hometowns. What are some of the trends?
I think the most interesting thing to me, having been immersed in this history for so long, is how much these things repeat. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the same discussions and arguments that are happening now were happening a long time ago. So when I believe it was Detroit opened their library, there was a big debate about whether or not it should be open on Sundays. And there was the whole, you know, movement of like, no, Sunday is the day of rest. It's the Lord's day. Nothing should be open. And then there was another point of view, which is like, that's the only day working people had off back then. So that's the only day that they would be able to go to the library. And each community kind of made separate decisions about like, are they going to be open on Sunday? Are they going to allow certain kinds of books? Are they going to let women be in the main reading room with men, or are they going to have them in their own separate little reading room because it's, you know, improper for women and men to sit together? Coming from the South, it's, are they going to allow African American citizens to use the library or not? Are they going to open up their own little segregated library? Are they going to not provide any library services? And nowadays, the fights seem to be about, well, what, actually, when we started the film, it was mostly about funding. Mm-hmm. There were big fights about, you know, who needs a library anymore now that we have the internet? We don't want to pay for these public services anymore. You know, a lot of communities where people don't use the library, they felt like, oh, only, you know, we shouldn't have to get taxed for this. And that's still going very strong, unfortunately, across the country. And now there's a lot of controversy about what's in the library, which I think is, it's been very traumatic for a lot of librarians, being under attack for what they have in the libraries. But it's also, to me, been very interesting to see how much people still care about their libraries. You know, these are still community conversations that are getting resolved. And it's the people who show up to those meetings who are going to determine what happens. So, you know, some of them are, there's huge political divides here, but my takeaway is like, these things are never settled. Yeah. We have to keep fighting them all the time. You know, democracy is fragile. And if we don't stand up for it,
and support them. What does supporting them mean? What does that look like now?
Like Dawn said, showing up at these meetings, donating money. There's always, at least in San Francisco, there's every 4 years, there's a bond measure that we have to vote for to help keep the libraries funded and a certain pool of money for them.
Not staying silent. If you love your librarians and you love your public library and you see that they're under attack and you don't agree with what's happening, you know, speaking up, showing up.
Writing letters.
If you think that, whether you agree with a particular book or not, if you think that it should be up to a very small group of parents to decide whether all the children in the community can read this book, that's, you know, and if you don't agree with that, then you need to, like, help make that book available to kids who might need it.
Yeah, being part of that conversation ongoing. Also, it occurs to me as I was watching this, the number of stories that go untold that are buried in the archives about our own librarians here in South Dakota, and who I know there's a Carnegie Library building not a few blocks from me. It's not functioning as a library anymore. Every community has these histories that it seems like there's a ripe openings for historical research and storytelling about how these librarians have shaped our rural communities, especially.
This morning, really quickly, I did a quick little Google search on South Dakota public libraries, and apparently Deadwood was the first one in, and it was a women's group that wrote to Carnegie and asked him for some seed money, and received it, I think, in 1903 or 4 or something like that. And then I read like something, I didn't read all of it, but there was something like, and men were admitted in 1906, something like that. That was fascinating. I'd like to learn more about that.
I was just trying to find it, but I don't see it right here. People were so proud of their libraries that there are thousands and thousands of postcards that were made of each library right after it was built. And there's just a stunningly beautiful one that we found from South Dakota, which unfortunately I do not see in my pile today, but it is in the film. And that was from the early 1900s. I believe it was from like 1906, right after the Carnegie Library was built. And it's just like, there's a cliff, there's... nothing in the distance for miles around except this one little library building. And it's like you really realize how much out on the frontier some of these places were, and how important it was to have a place to go to get books, because otherwise you were totally cut off from the world. And then we also found this beautiful old film that was made by the State Library of South Dakota in the 1960s. I believe it was 65. And it's the bookmobile, making it out to all these different communities in South Dakota, including some of the Native American reservations and farms that are super isolated, and going along these beautiful roads all across the state. And that was one of my favorite finds.
Oh, wonderful.
Thank you. And we really hope that everybody who's listening comes to their library to watch this with their community. You know, it's one thing to watch it at home on your computer, but the public library isn't just the place you go to get books. It's one of the last places that we have to talk about things with people that we don't necessarily agree with. And so we hope that the film sparks some interesting conversations and real dialogue, and opens people up to some new ideas.
SDPB is hosting screenings and community conversations for Free for All. The first is March 5th at the Sioux Falls Downtown Library. The second, March 6th in the Rapid City Public Library. Learn more at sdpb.ticketbud.com. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We are ending our library hour with a conversation with Elise Graham. You'll hear the story of how American librarians and scholars helped save the world from Nazis. Graham is a scholar and author. Her latest book is called Book and Dagger, How Scholars and Librarians Became the Unlikely Spies of World War II. We begin with the fact that America didn't know what he was doing regarding spycraft before we entered World War II.
At the beginning of World War II, the U.S. didn't have a standing spy agency. So the head of the OSS, which was the wartime predecessor to the CIA, William Donovan, decided that he needed to get experts in every field as quickly as he could. And he decided the best way to do that was to recruit as spies and intelligence agents as many librarians and professors as he could.
Why librarians and archivists and professors? What was his thought process there?
Well, for one thing, he needed expertise in every subject in the library. He needed to know about mapping. He needed to know about geography. He needed to know about certain areas of the world. He needed to understand how to read whatever texts were available front and back and sideways. And the best way to get expertise on every subject in the library is to just raid the library for recruits. So people were getting calls in the library, or government agents would stop by your classroom while you were teaching, or you would be recruited during a college football game when nobody would notice another alumni-looking guy in a suit walking around campus. These guys were pulled out of their library carrels and thrown into dangerous wartime situations.
And some of them were ready for that. What kind of people were recruited, and what sort of information did you find about their mental preparation to take on that kind? We'll get to their training in a minute, but just, were they inclined to be adventurous people?
Some of them were very much. Some of them had been, knowingly or not, waiting for that phone call all their life. I mean, listen, in movies, spies are sort of ripped hunks who carry lots of gadgets. But in real life, a weapon would blow somebody's cover. The best way to be a spy is to be the sort of person who's easily overlooked. And these spies, librarians and professors, were chosen precisely because they would be overlooked. But that didn't mean they weren't good detectives. And that didn't mean they didn't have exactly what it took in terms of fortitude and ingenuity to be excellent undercover agents. So one of these historical figures was Adele Kyber. She got her PhD in classics at the University of Chicago. And then, because women had a hard time becoming professors in those days, she built herself a career traveling around Europe and taking photographs of hard-to-find texts in different libraries. That meant that she became an expert in tracking down hard-to-find texts and also in doing all of the kind of personal working of people that you need to do in order to get access to things you might not otherwise get access to. She was contacted by the OSS and asked whether she would like to put her talents toward becoming an undercover agent who found documents for the OSS in wartime Stockholm.
Yeah, and they are going to ask her to find some far-flung documents and texts. How much pressure did they put on her to find ways to come up with rare books and pamphlets and papers?
Well, she found all kinds of documents that she really shouldn't have gotten access to. She was able to get underground newspapers. She was able to get books that the Germans had designated as secret books and taken off of the shelves. She was able to get industry directories. She was able to get scientific journals that were no longer sent to the United States, some of which were sent to the library at a little place in New Mexico called Los Alamos. She was the most productive documents acquisition agent of the war. She was able to acquire a tremendous amount of material, a lot of which she acquired by making friends with not just with people in the underground, for instance, but with Germans or people who were allied with Germans. Yeah. She seemed to present to everyone she met a reflection of what they wanted to see. Hmm. She also seemed to have been waiting her whole life to be able to use her talents in a way that was this intensive and this consequential.
And it's not an exaggeration to say that these people did things that helped win the war or save the world from Nazism. That's not hyperbole.
No, not in the least bit. Their methods were so successful that, the war was fought on battlefields, but it was won in libraries. Their work was so successful that it changed the way that we do modern intelligence. The methods of the CIA are still based on the framework that they laid down. And rumor has it that to this day, the CIA does recruiting at the annual American Library Association conference. I can't say whether that's definitely true, but I went to the conference last year and the CIA was there. So I think that, I think that the lessons of that fight were learned by the intelligence establishment and haven't been forgotten since.
That's Elise Graham. Her book is called Book and Dagger: How Scholars and Librarians Became the Unlikely Spies of World War II. Remember, SDPB is hosting screenings and community conversations for Free for All, the documentary, the first, March 5th, at the Sioux Falls Downtown Library, the second, March 6th, in the Rapid City Public Library. Learn more at sdpb.ticketbud.com. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman. I'm Lori Walsh. From all of us at SDPB, thank you for listening.